Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Barbara Sittler, and her topic of the day is Living Wills and Advanced Directives. So let's listen in on Barbara Sittler.
Beginning. In 1991, Congress passed a Patient Self-Determination Act, which was an act that came about in the wake of the Nancy Cruzan and Karen Ann Quinlan cases, both of which involved a young woman who was kept on artificial life support beyond the time that her family and friends felt that she would want to be on it. And the case was appealed finally to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that patients should be allowed to exercise some kind of documentation about what their wishes are for medical care toward the end of their life, or in the event of a catastrophic illness. So advanced directives came about as a result of that act. Now, essentially what an advanced directive is simply a written document that expresses what your wishes are in terms of health care. If you're in a terminal condition or have a catastrophic illness. So that's all an advance directive is. Within that big framework, let me get a couple of these.
I'll give you two of these.
So underneath the rubric of an advance directive are two legal forms, and they're the living will and durable power of attorney. And both of them are included in this packet. Now, the Patient Self-Determination Act, which set up this framework wherein you have an advance directive, said that any hospital, any nursing home, any healthcare facility, or any HMO that received any kind of federal funding was required by law to provide any patient and all patients that are coming in to see them with written documentation of what an advance directive was and both the living will and durable power of attorney. So that is any place in the United States that gets, so you will probably, when you check into a hospital, they say, do you have a living will? And they hand you a little packet. That's what the act is. The living will is a document that you sign, and it has different levels of treatment in it. And you put your name on it, you check a box saying, I do or do not want this kind of care. And it can run from, I want my life to be preserved at all costs. I want everything to be done to that is medically possible. It goes from that and to I don't want my life to be preserved by any artificial means. And usually what is meant by that is they don't want if you go into cardiac arrest, you do not want to be revived through cardiopulmonary resuscitation. You don't want to be put on a ventilator. You don't want to be kept alive on artificial nutrition and hydration. Those are those are pretty much the categories that you will check on a living will. Now, a durable power of attorney is different than a living will in that you say, in the event that I'm incapacitated, I will name X person to serve as my agent or proxy. And that person is directed to serve on my behalf. And I think the way that it's put here, that this person is to make healthcare decisions in the event that I am unable to make them for myself. Once again, there are three boxes that you can check, and I'll read that out to you because I think being specific is probably a better idea here. The first one says, I do not want my life to be prolonged, nor do I want life-sustaining treatment to be provided or continued. If my agent believes the burden of the treatment outweighs the expected benefits, I want my agent to consider the relief of suffering, the expense involved, and the quality as well as the possible extension of my life in making decisions concerning life-sustaining treatment. That's choice one. Choice two, I want my life to be prolonged, and I want life-sustaining treatment to be provided or continued, unless I am in a coma, which my attending physician believes to be irreversible, in accordance with reasonable medical standards at the time of reference. If and when I have suffered an irreversible coma, I want life-sustaining treatment to be withheld or withdrawn. The final category is, I want my life to be prolonged to the greatest extent possible without regard to my condition, the chances I have for recovery, or the cost of procedures. Now, what this does is this gives your proxy or your agent some window of an idea of how you feel about the end of your life, how far you want to go. And it gives also the physicians, the whole medical care team, and your family a sort of a concise view of how you feel about things. So just to refer, the living will is a statement that talks about if you're in a coma or an irreversible situation, you want treatment withdrawn. The durable power of attorney speaks about those issues, but it also speaks about any other kind of medical contingency where you can't, the physician can't come to you and say, look, you're not in a coma, but you're dying of cancer. And you're in such bad shape now that you will not recover. What do you want me to do? You can't answer because you're in such bad shape. Your proxy can then make decisions for you. So most people will say it's a good idea to have both, but the durable power of attorney will provide you with a greater amount of coverage and latitude because it covers many different eventualities. There are some problems with this, which I'll get into in a minute, but just so that you're clear on the distinction. The interest in the durable power of attorney or the whole issue of advanced directives has really come up a lot since this Patient Self-Determination Act was signed in 1991. And this last summer, interest was spurred again through the deaths of both Richard Nixon and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Both of them had executed advanced directives. And both of them, recall Richard Nixon had a stroke and decided that he did not want aggressive measures to be taken, and he died several days later. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis similarly was dying of lymphoma, knew that she was dying, wanted to be home and conscious insofar as possible to the end of her life, and did not want heroic measures taken. Both of those people have sort of stimulated the environment so that we can continue to talk about these things, and hopefully have stimulated the environment to the extent that people are starting to talk with their families and friends about these things, which is the main reason I bring this up here. And I think it's at this point, it's probably important for me to say that the reason I'm interested in this is that I went through the illness and deaths of both of my parents, neither of whom had a living will or an advanced durable power of attorney. My father had spoken at some length about his concerns about extent of care and the end of his life, end of life issues. And so we were fairly clear about what he wanted. My mother, however, had been maddeningly, sometimes she'd say, the line that we always remembered was that she said, oh, when it comes time for me to die, I just want to walk out into the snow like the Eskimos and fall asleep. I think that's a wonderful way to go. Well, my mother, in 1968, began to have difficulty walking. And ultimately, she was diagnosed with some sort of a disease, a demyelinating disease, which means that the myelin sheath along the spinal column doesn't carry nerve impulses correctly from brain to muscle. It was like multiple sclerosis, but it wasn't exactly. They didn't know what was causing it. They didn't know how long she had, but that they were not very optimistic about her prognosis. 10 years later, she began to suffer Alzheimer's disease, what we believe is Alzheimer's disease. Probably it wasn't 10 years later, it was probably sooner, but it became obvious to us about 10 years later that mommy was not okay. She would be very angry at her sense of confusion, at the changes in her body, at her decreased ability to move around, but she would never say what she wanted. And it was mommy. I couldn't talk to her about her dying. I mean, she'd already beaten the doctor's odds by 10 years. And she, you know, you don't want to talk to your mother. I mean, it was mommy. It was never mom or mother. It was always mommy all my life. There were 6 of us kids. Almost everyone in my family is in the medical profession, is either a nurse or a physician. We just never talked about it. 10 years after that, she was in, by this time she was bedridden. She had had the tendons in her legs severed so that she could straighten out her legs. She was no longer able to talk with any coherence. She couldn't eat very well. She was showing increased signs of agitation, and she suffered, this was actually not 10 years later, it was 1987, she suffered 6 tiny strokes. She couldn't swallow. At the same time, my father was in advanced stages of skin cancer and was at the end of his life. We were doing round-the-clock care for both of them. They were both at home. And on the best decision of my brother, who is a gastroenterologist, we inserted a feeding tube into my mom, which is just making a small incision into your belly and putting a tube right into your stomach and adding liquid nutrition. We didn't know what to do with the strokes. She was probably going to die pretty soon anyway. We were busy with Daddy. Well, she lived for 3.5 years after that. And at that time, nutrition and hydration were seen as, were categorized in the same way as ventilator, it was a life support treatment. We could not withdraw, we could not legally withdraw the nutrition and hydration from my mother. Furthermore, we could not as a family come to understand or agree what it was we should do. After all, she had been sick for years. If she wanted us to know something about what to do, she would have told us. Well, maybe she would have, maybe she wouldn't have. The fact is that she did not. And as a family, we had never come to have discussions about these things. What eventually happened was that she just died, very suddenly. On a morning, we came in, she had stopped absorbing the feedings. Her stomach was hard. My brother, the physician, came over. We were with her all day. She seemed not to be not in good shape, but just at one spot. We all went home, and 15 minutes later, she was dead. And there are members of my family who are still not speaking to each other because the feelings were so strong about what we should have done or what we should not have done. I began to study this issue as a result of that because I think that, and then the Patient Self-Determination Act came about, too late for mom, but not too late for us, to start to find ways to think about what we want to do. I also began to think about this as a person who's going into the ministry, as what it is that we can, as families and communities, do about these kinds of questions. What sorts of issues are brought up when we think about our life and our death, about the suffering of our loved ones? What kinds of roles should we play as congregations, as children of elderly parents, as elderly people ourselves or those of us who are? How do we start to address these issues? I think one of the big ways is to hand these things out like popcorn, which is what I do. I mean, everybody I know has got these things. And say, start thinking about these things. Start talking about them. What do you want to do? So that's the first part of what I wanted to say. Should I stop here? And do we have any questions or any comments? Okay. Now, it's been 3 years since this act, 2.5 years since this act has been signed. And there was a great brouhaha about the act and what was going to happen. And there have been studies made about how many people have actually filled out living wills or durable powers of attorney. And at this point, the studies indicate that between 5 and 15% of adult Americans have filled up living wills or durable powers of attorney. That's a very small number of people. And the question that arises is, why is that? People were so concerned about these issues, why haven't they filled out living wills? And some of the studies have indicated that they've talked to both those people who have filled them out, those people who intend to fill them out but have not yet done so, and those people who haven't done them at all. And some fairly consistent patterns have emerged. The people who say that they would like to fill out living wills or durable advance directives have said, but haven't said, that they're just too complicated. They don't understand exactly what to do. The forms are too long. They need help. They would like someone to help them fill this out. Many of them have suggested that it would be wonderful if their physician would bring the issue up with them and help them fill out living wills or durable powers of attorney. Many of the people, it turns out, who have not filled out living wills and who are not interested in filling out advance directives are those people who are in general less educated or living in rural areas, who really don't understand, have not been exposed to this kind of thing and are uneasy about entering into a legal arrangement about their health care and end of life. Other people say that they have a great deal of difficulty talking about this issue with members of their family. They would like to fill out a living will or a durable power of attorney, but they don't know how to bring it up. They don't want to upset their family members. When they have brought it up, that has created a great deal of trouble. And added to that is the difficulty of selecting a proxy. Generally speaking, you'll select somebody in your family or someone who's a close friend. Within a family, that can create some difficulties. Who am I going to pick? Who am I not going to pick? Can I really trust anybody to understand what I mean? Those are very difficult decisions. I'm one of six children. I filled out my advance directives the day of my mother's funeral. But I did have problems picking out the proxy, and I still do. And I picked my sister, who's a nurse. And we talk about it all the time. Because I said, well, now, you know, I read about this. If that happened, you know, I'd want you to keep me alive a little longer. Another issue, which I find very troubling, is that members of minorities have not filled out advance directives because they have a suspicion that having an advance directive in place may suggest to their health care providers that they can give them less care than they are entitled to. That because they have said they do not want their life to be artificially prolonged, public hospitals, state-owned hospitals, physicians who see them as a cash cow, or as a drain on them, will give them less care because they say, well, they didn't want to live that long anyway, so I don't have to treat as aggressively as I might. So there are those issues that are preventing people from filling them out. Those people who have filled out living wills have also similarly had similar strains that have come up in their reasons of why they have filled out advance directives. And those have been uniformly that they have a very strong belief that an advance directive is the means whereby their wishes can be definitively made known. That they want to participate in their health care till the time of their death. That's a very important aspect of their life and of their death, and they want to be part of it. They don't want to give up that control. If they have to give up control, they want to make sure the person they give it up to has as much information from themselves as possible. They also believe that by having advance directives in place, they are making things much easier for their family. They are not placing the burden of these decisions on family members without having let them know, at least in general terms, how they feel about these things. And finally, this surprised me a little bit. They felt that it would make it easier on their physicians. That physicians are driven to protect us, to care for us, to heal us and cure us. death is often seen as an enemy. And in that kind of a situation, a physician can do their best for you, frequently in their own mind, by keeping death away. If you let a physician know that that's not how you feel, that death at a certain point is a normative condition for each and every one of us, you can untie the physician's hands and say, look, provide for my dignity, for my health care, for my comfort, and when it seems clear that my death is coming, let's not fight it so much. So, this past year I worked at the University of Illinois Hospital as a chaplaincy intern for the geriatric service. And I wasn't working out of the geriatrics department, out of the pastoral care department, I was working out of the geriatrics department. The distinction being that I was working with the physicians and the nurses and the other caregivers as part of the decision-making team. And I got the opportunity to talk with physicians a great deal about how they felt about this. And it seems to me that it is true that if the patient can let the physician and the physician and the patient's family know where they stand, it does make things a lot easier. Some of their hesitation about talking to their patients about advanced directives is that they see this as not really the realm of a physician. They wish that a patient would have talked to their pastor or religious person, family members, their loved ones, their larger community, and presented a sort of a cohesive view of how they felt so that the physician and the patient could then start to plan based on the patient's basic views rather than the physician having to intuit or to initiate this conversation. Now there are physicians, I had breakfast with one this morning, who feels very differently, that he feels very comfortable about bringing up these issues. Most of the patients he sees, he's had for many, many years. He feels a responsibility and obligation to his patients to talk about the end of their life, as well as the care they have during the course of their life. But I would suggest that that's probably not as common as we would like, and certainly in urban areas, and for people who are going to be relying on public care, that's not common at all to have an ongoing relationship with a physician who will take the time to speak with you about these things. So this brings me around to how we can get more people to talk about these issues. My father was pastor, and I would have thought, since he spent all of his life as a pastor and a theologian and a teacher, he even was here, seen by many people as someone who felt comfortable bringing up lots of issues and talking about things that were controversial, that this would have been an easy thing to talk about amongst our own family, and it was not. Furthermore, during the course of both of my parents' illnesses and death, the church was not comfortable talking about these issues. They were not comfortable coming to family, to the home, and visiting my parents who were obviously dying, and dying not very graciously and gracefully. The questions that we had about how much care we should provide, what we should do about my mother who was on a feeding tube and we wanted to withdraw it, and there were splits and divisions in the families, these were not things that pastors or friends of the family felt comfortable addressing, giving advice on, helping. And I have a lot of different feelings about that, but I can understand that at the time of crisis, nobody wants to be the traffic director there. Now is not the time to talk when we've got to decide right now, does mommy get the tube or doesn't she? Does daddy go to the emergency room and get put on a ventilator or not? The time to talk about it is much, much earlier. And to talk about it as a sort of a whole part of how we experience our life and our death, our sense of belonging and community. I would guess there's nobody in this room who hasn't in some way been affected by death, the decisions that have had to be made, by the pain that's been caused by family with differing ideas about what kind of care a parent should receive. So it's not something that's foreign to us. It's not something that happens to us once in a lifetime. It happens repeatedly with our grandparents, our parents, ourselves, our children. siblings, friends. And so I would suggest that one of the greatest things that we could all do is to start to bring these things up in sermons, as church policies, think tanks, everything. There are lots of ways we can talk about these things. Senior centers, coffee hours. I've tried to get my, at my congregation, I hand these things out like popcorn, I'm doing a coffee hour in the fall and a sermon. I'm doing a sermon on one Sunday on the whole issue of physician-assisted suicide in hospice, which I'm talking about tomorrow, and a coffee hour on advanced directives. Let people know about it. We can have them there. People can sign them. People can not sign them. They can take them home. We can break into groups if we want to and just start talking about this. Talking about it a lot, talking about it frequently, and sort of taking the sting out of these issues. It's not as if we're going to not have to deal with them. Now, up to this point, I've been talking about advanced directives as if they're wonderful things, or perhaps I have. They're not altogether wonderful. There are some problems in having an advanced directive, and I think it's only fair that we should talk about those as well. I referred to this a little bit earlier, that there are questions of justice in healthcare, and particularly in this climate now where healthcare reform or lack of reform is going to be coming. People, I think, are very concerned about the uneasy alliance or the uneasy tension between limiting care on the one hand, or limiting procedures on the one hand, and the economic dynamic that's going to go on with that. If a hospital administrator, for example, knows that everyone in this room has a living will and a durable power of attorney, and we don't want extraordinary measures taken to keep ourselves alive at the end of death, he can pretty much count on the fact that this group is going to be a little bit less expensive to take care of than the other group who says, do everything. Now, what is that going to mean about our care? Is it going to mean that they're going to be start doing a kind of an economic triage where we start getting less care from the beginning? There's a term which is put on people's charts toward the end when their condition is terminal, which is called a DNR, do not resuscitate. And usually a chart in a hospital will have a little red flag or some kind of notation on it so that you know that that patient's clear to everyone. When that patient goes into cardiac arrest, you're not going to bring them around. That's usually something that happens when you have a durable power of attorney. You can also have a DNR order if you don't have an advance directive, but it goes hand in glove. Now, DNR does not mean, a do not resuscitate does not mean do not treat. And in this time when advance directives alone are new, they're altogether new in the medical climate, the education that goes on in hospitals is variable. There will be many people in hospitals who will think, many people who will be caring for us, who will think that a DNR is tantamount to, like, well, don't do anything for this person. There are times when aggressive treatment is entirely appropriate. We're not terminal. We're not dying. We may need something to jumpstart us for a minute, but that's not going to keep us on a machine for the rest of our life. So there are some problems with wondering whether an advance directive may adversely affect the kind of care that we're going to get. Those things have to be addressed. They have to be talked about with our physicians, and I think it's something that we have to be careful about and think about, and it's not entirely within our control. So it is something that's troubling. It's less troubling for those who can pick their physicians and their who have good quality medical care and are not reliant on public care, public aid so much. Which is not to say that public aid is bad, but it is generally true that persons who rely on public aid for medical care are not going to be establishing a long-term relationship with their physician. They have to rely on a bunch of people who they have never seen before and who don't know them. They're going to have to rely on the strength of the system to make these distinctions. And as of yet, it's still a little weak. I think it will get much better as time goes on, but advanced directives are new. There's also the question of how well, if I were to sign a living will now, which I have, saying I do not want to be kept alive, I do not want to be my life prolonged through machines. Well, how do I know what that means? I mean, in 20 years, who knows what that's going to mean? I mean, maybe that's a completely, if I'm in something that would normally be fatal now, in 20 years, let's say, look, we hook her up to this machine for a week, we can do this, we can do that, she'll be fine. She may not be fine, but she'll live, and she will have a quality of life. It will not be what she had before, but it will certainly be a good life, and a life in which she can be creative and active and continue to live and be part of a family and a group. So advanced directives, particularly living wills, can tend to narrow our focus and the focus of care, the focus of the instructions we give to our physicians in a somewhat artificial way. So recently, what people have been saying is, I went over these boxes that you can check, particularly when you fill out a durable power of attorney and you assign a proxy. And they're the three boxes that most closely approximate how you feel about your long-term care. The suggestion that most people are giving now is don't check any of them. You don't have to check any of them. You can discuss what each of those different statements means. You can talk to your proxy, to your family, often and regularly about how you feel. But if you check a particular box, you can be legally binding them to say, well, she says in this, no ventilator. So no ventilator. Even though I believe that if she were on a ventilator for 2 days here, this would really save her life. So it's better, we're suggesting that the medical community and some pastoral care workers and ethics consultation groups, bioethics groups, are suggesting that it is much better to talk about what you want, to regularly assess and reassess how you feel about these issues, and to make sure that your proxy knows what you're thinking. Because this gives them the sense that what they're trying to do is speak for you. It's much easier to speak for another person if you're holding these conversations pretty regularly. Research has demonstrated that most people who fill out durable powers of attorney and living wills are pretty consistent within a 2-year period. After 2 years, they may want to talk about it and say, well, you know, what about this or what about that? My father, again, when he all through his life said, you know, when it's time to go, I just want to go. I just want to go. That's the way it is. I've lived an old life. I'm an old man. I can hardly see. I can hardly hear. I can't work anymore. I can't taste a damn thing. You know, when it's time to go, it's time to go. Well, you know, when it was time to go, he didn't want to go. He said, how about that feeding tube? Because he couldn't swallow. He had cancer in his ear. He'd had a lot of radiation to work on the cancer, but the side effect of the radiation was that it wiped out all the nerves in this part of his body. He couldn't swallow. He couldn't close his eye. His whole mouth drooped. He had a lot of pain all over here from dried up all the salivary glands. So he's always dry and had to be kept, his mouth had to be kept moist through swabs. And he would have died. He couldn't eat anymore. So when it came to that point, he said, I'd like a feeding tube, just like mommy's got. So we had them both hooked up to feeding tubes. Now, in his case, I rather suspect the reason he was not ready to die was that it was 6 weeks before Christmas, and I know I went in there and told him that he was not allowed to die before Christmas. He said, I want to die by Christmas, and I became very exercised and said, you've had it your way all your life. This is an outrage. You know, Christmas is our time, Pop. So he died right after Christmas. Now, it may be that he just wanted to stay alive for us. It may be that when the time came that he knew that his death was imminent, he really didn't want to die. So the problem with advanced directives here is that they can't, unless you have long conversations with your family, with your pastors, with your group, your community, and you can continuously have those conversations, even as you're in the dying process, they may not speak, they may not be able to talk about what you feel in ways that are consistent with how you're feeling right there when it's when you're looking down the barrel of the gun. So those are things that are a little bit problematic. And that's why the proxy is sort of a better way out than just the living will, because it can give greater latitude. And it is all, let's see. It is also true that when people who, even those people who have advanced directives, come to the point at which their life is coming to an end, they will say when they filled out the advanced directive that they want no extraordinary measures taken. But they also will say when they are really very ill that they do feel comfortable with allowing a little bit of leeway on those wishes. If their physician, who they trust, thinks that this treatment might be effective, can I do this? They will generally say they want their proxy to be able to say, okay, try it. We don't have to continue this, let's try it. They want, they give their proxy, their family, their physician, some leeway. And I think that this is very intelligent, that it's not just, it's not something that's completely written in stone and this is the way that it is. And I suspect that for all of us who've gone through anything like this, we know that emotions run high, feelings are very intense, situations change. Maybe you do want to permit some leeway so that your child can get through it, so that you can give them time to come to terms with the death of a parent or of a sibling, or maybe give yourself time to come to terms with it. That's fine. And again, by filling out the proxy but not filling out those boxes, you allow for that leeway. And so that pretty much signals the idea that the living will, advanced directive, should always be considered as a work in progress. That it's something you start talking about and working with, and then you continue to refer back to it, you reflect on it, you see what's going on, you see what's happening with family and friends, see what's happening in the courts. There's an amazing amount of literature coming out and media attention to this. It can change the way we all feel about these things very often. I was, in my family, I was the person who was the most strongly in favor of withdrawing the nutrition and hydration tube from my mother. I felt that she was suffering a great deal, that she didn't want to be kept alive. She wanted to die gracefully and with dignity, and we were depriving her of that. Part of what happened to her over the course of time was that her muscles became constricted. She was drawn up like that, and we finally had to get lamb's wool so that when she gripped, she closed her hands, her nails wouldn't dig into her flesh, even though her nails were, we kept them cut very short, we had a full-time nurse. But just the muscles tightened up so badly, you had to do that. Another thing that she did was that she had contractures in her mouth so that over time she had bitten away all of her lip, bit by bit. It was a horrible thing. And we finally got her on a little bit of Valium to loosen up her muscles. But she was strong as an ox. And her body was under no strain whatsoever. Aside from the fact that she was, you know, had Alzheimer's and an Alzheimer's type disease and a multiple sclerosis type of disease. She was being taken care of. She was getting 24-hour care. She was getting perfect nutrition. She was in better shape than she'd ever been. And I said, we should take her off. This is absolutely outrageous. Other members of my family, my brother, the physician, said, from the time of the Greeks, murdering your mother has been the worst sin imaginable. How could you say a thing like that? How could you talk about murdering mommy? Well, I didn't see it quite in those terms. But he had a good point, that what I was saying was, let's take away her means of survival. She left us no way of knowing. She didn't want to talk about it. It was gross. Let's just let things happen. Well, in the old days, things did just happen. But technology and science and a greater sense of what we can do for each other has sort of removed that possibility from just letting things take their natural course. And for the most part, that's wonderful. Technology, medical technology, has been a wonderful thing for all of us. In this case, maybe sometimes not so much. I forget where I was going with this, but just, so I think that we should really talk with each other about these things. And I do think that insofar as I'm a member of a Lutheran community, I feel very strongly that it is in that context and framework that some of these conversations can begin most effectively. Because they will talk not only about what it is to live, but what it is to die, what it is to be responsible for each other, what it is to care for each other, how that care can be consistent with keeping someone on a machine, taking them off a machine. Big issues of value. But I have talked an awful lot, and certainly somebody here must have something to say. Yeah.
Some congregations are facing this. There's a small one up Sullivan, in Minnesota, where my relatives go, or my cousin, who send out like a funeral plan, what songs they wanted, their wishes, cremation or burial, whatever. And then they also have sent some like living wills. And a few years ago, Seattle Times had an article copied out of the Boston Globe, which is almost like a grid, which I had filled out and had notarized, which kinds of care you want, you know, and all these kinds of things. And I shared the same funeral plan with quite a few pastors in Oregon where I live.
Oh, that's great.
And plus dozens of friends. And it is something I think that is being talked about more. And I have handed those out from the Oregon side, like popcorn also.
But yeah.
Both my parents had living wills, but even with them, there were times I had to tell the doctor that didn't want any more. I had thought they would be sufficient, and they maybe were too on, or weren't vague, I guess is the word I want. And with mom, I remember the doctor saying, I was hoping you would say that.
Oh.
The Catholic doctor. And then after she died, the nurse said, I hope I have the courage that you did. And at the time,
to let her go.
The thing you do, letting them go. But they had, thank God, both talked about it. The very summer mom died is when we had the living home in Manhattan.
And did you find that helpful?
Oh, very, knowing what they wanted, yes. That I knew I was acting for them. It helps a lot if the family members have those wishes made known ahead of time, obviously.
There is something that's being developed now, which is called a values history, which helps also. I've got one here that's woefully inadequate, which I'll pass along for you to look at. There are some other ones that are being developed by different church groups or ministry, health ministry projects, in which you, rather than say, do you want to be kept alive on a ventilator, it starts to talk about what your basic values are, so that you can come to some sorts of decisions, or better yet, your proxy can. What value do you place on being conscious till the end of your life? What value do you place on being independent, on managing your own money? What did you think about the life and death of your parents? Sort of it gets a much bigger view of what your fundamental values are, and so that provides a means of determining what someone will want in the absence of an explicit. I mean, the problem is that so often in terminal care, you're faced with something that you haven't addressed specifically. So, well, what's the spirit of what mom would have wanted?
In our home health agencies, of course, are getting into hospice, and they're handing out a lot of information in the community through public health fairs, through other types of public demonstrations and things. So a lot of people who are not connected with churches or other things like that are getting information. But that's the thing, though, the problem would be that I had the situation where my sister was the proxy and she was overseas on a trip when my mother became very ill, and we had to make a decision. My younger sister and I were standing there saying, what do we do? We don't know what my mother wanted because the other sister was the proxy. So we had to make a decision right then and there. And so that's another problem that can happen with just one proxy, is the possibility of ever having more than one.
Yes, you can have, you can name a proxy. You, what they suggest, you don't name a co-proxy, because you need one person who will speak.
Yeah.
But you can designate, if this person's not there, then the next one. But you see, that's why I'm saying that talking among the family as a sort of a regular thing, it doesn't have to be this dreadful, morbid conversation at all. But then you would have known.
Well, we basically did. We didn't realize what we were talking about. We basically knew what Mother wanted. But it was, we felt uncomfortable making the decision when she was the one that had appointed, even though we did finally do it in at the time. My sister, who was the proxy, was the one that was upset because she wasn't there.
Right.
And she had a lot of trouble with that.
Oh, I
later.
Bet.
Because she wasn't there when she should have been, but that was another issue.
Yeah, but those can be. I mean, I don't take lightly at all the fact that that here was a family, my family, that was intelligent and thought a lot about. I mean, we're almost everybody in my family is in healthcare in one form or another. And my father, I know, had talked a lot about the question of aging and dying and diminishment. And yet this issue had never been talked about as a group. And so the divisions that were created have really been very, very destructive in my family. And really cut to the core of questions that we have about our own values. And if you believe this, you can't love Mom. Or if you believe that, you can't love Dad, or you're. And then there's the question of conflict of interest. That's the other thing I wanted to bring up. When you name a proxy, that can be a little bit of a problem. If you are leaving a $3 million estate to someone who stands to benefit enormously.
And is in debt.
And is in debt. I mean, let's see. You got someone who's a drug addict, in debt, highly volatile, very suggestible, and going to get your whole estate on your demise. How much do you want to, we're human beings. And I know that the night that my mom died, I drove my brother home, then we got the phone call, she died. We drove back down to where she was living, which was a considerable distance, and then stayed overnight. And the next morning, I drove my brother home again. And I said, all for 3.5 years, I've been saying we should have withdrawn this feeding. I mean, I've been adamant about it. But over the course of the 24 hours, she had been without feeding and without any liquid, any fluid. And she was obviously uncomfortable. And I said, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it. After I saw what she just went through. And it was incredible to me that faced with it, no, I wouldn't do it. So you really need the support and sort of everybody to be on the same page insofar as that's possible. Yeah.
I appreciate what you said about the drawbacks of having, the particular checklist. My mother's in a nursing home, just moved her to one in the Chicago area, and had the staff physician about a week ago. I have durable power of attorney and only child. But about a week ago, he gave me the form he uses, which has six, very particular technical procedures as to, these are things I don't want done. I actually came up here without actually having checked that because, as an ethicist and one who, helped work in that ELCA end of life decisions message, et cetera, it was too narrow to focus it only on that. And even though I do have a basic sense of what my mother wants, to, in an isolated way, say, well, I don't want this technique performed. I just could not check that.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that. I guess I also want to ask, though, then, about the kind of the downside of that. If you don't have something like that checked, do you run the real risk of certain extraordinary measures being put into use?
What you have to do then.
Before you have that chance to talk it over with the doctor.
Well, what it does require is that you have to be vigilant and you have to be there. It's
mm-hmm.
true. So if you don't have them checked, if you do have a durable power of attorney, what the physician and medical team will know is that you have to be consulted.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they're going to say, well, we had to make the decision immediately, and there was no reason not to, so they could put somebody on a ventilator. You could have them withdrawn, which is a much harder thing to do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it does mean that you have to be there, or the second proxy has to be there, and you have to be pretty involved and engaged in what's being done. You have to let the physician know who you are you planning, what's the next step, what does that entail, no, I don't want that, or explain to me. So you do have to be very directive. It doesn't mean it's a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, I was at a conference last week sponsored by the Park Ridge Center and the Clinical Medical Ethics, whatever, from Rush. And there were a number of physicians and lawyers and ethicists there who said that overall, and particularly the physicians said, that they thought not checking the boxes was the best for the patient, because it meant that they could confer with the proxy and really do everything that they thought was best for the patient, but not violate any of the intentions that the patient had put forward. But that the technology is advancing so rapidly now that, you know, you don't know. Let's, you know, and you always have the option of saying no, but then this allows true medical care to be given, because the physician is in consultation and the physician is protected, you're protected, the patient is protected.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to be there, it is true. Yeah.
It seems like you've said yes and no maybe a little bit too. If you start something like putting the tube in the stomach, are there laws in some states that require it to be kept there?
There were, up until 1991. Nutrition and hydration was always seen as a slightly different category than, say, being on a ventilator, because a ventilator breathes for you, whereas nutrition and hydration, ethically, was seen as a fundamental, something that all people needed at all times. You cannot survive without nutrition and hydration, whether you get it in a tube, whether you get it in a, you know, on a fork, a knife, whatever. It's just a basic human need, and it's not a technological one step removed by having a ventilator move lungs for you. All this was doing was giving you the food. Your body's doing the rest. So there were laws against withdrawing it because it was seen as withdrawing a fundamental right of human existence. Now there are not. Now you can remove it. It's a lot easier, it's a lot easier emotionally not to have it put in. It's also a lot easier logistically not to stop it from being put in than to have it taken out, because there's still a very strong emotional thing that runs through not only the family but the physicians and the care team that you are starving somebody to death, and it's a very weighted issue. But no, it is not illegal any longer. You can say I want that removed, and the fact of the matter is that you can keep people extremely comfortable. What people say is, do you have any idea what it's like to see somebody starve to death or to die of thirst, which is what I was starting to watch my mother do? You can provide them with comfort. You can give them enough medication so they don't feel it. You can also give them enough fluid so that they're not uncomfortable, but they're not being sufficiently fed. I mean, they're not being given fluid to keep them alive, but to just keep them comfortable. So, but as I say, it's only since the December of 1991 that this changed. So it's very new, and I suspect it will change some more. But the basic and most important thing is that you do have legal rights to speak for your own care, and if you're appointed proxy, to speak for the care of those who've named you proxy. So.
I was just going to say, I discussed with my internist, and she also has a copy of it. And she said what has been her experience oftentimes is the caregiver, who was maybe in Oregon, is ready to have the life support system shut off. But some sibling who hasn't been on the scene at all will fly in and say no, they want them kept alive. And she said that has happened to her a number of times.
Yeah.
She said her hands as a doctor are tied, but she hates seeing this happen. And they fly away again, and the caregiver is still there.
Yes, this morning I had breakfast with an oncologist who said the same thing, and who also said that if a patient is dying, you know, he said, you know, they're dying. I'm keeping them comfortable. They're on a morphine drip. Their death is imminent. that the children will fly in, say, from California and say, look, I can't, she's dying. Can't you just give her a little something to, you know, I can't take off any more time. We've got the funeral, I've got family out there, and I'm on limited income. If she's going to die in 4 or 5 days, can't she die tomorrow? And he said, you know, that's... you know, well, no, actually she can't. But he said, but you know, in a way, they are dying. I mean, there is no chance that they will recover, but it's very, very difficult. So talking is like the greatest thing you could possibly do. One little note, when I filled out my living will and durable power of attorney, I went to my pastor. I gave a copy to everyone in my family. I've talked about it like crazy. Named my sister proxy, and then I put my pastor's name down as someone who should hold a copy of it and said, this is what I want. I want you to, you know, in case there's any problems, I want you to speak on my behalf. I can't do that. I cannot do that. And it took me 5 years to convince this guy that he didn't agree with what I said, but he would support what I said. And so it, you know, you run into lots of complicated issues, and I can only urge you that the more you talk about them in a non-crisis situation, you will be also, the gift it gives is that you start to talk to each other in ways that maybe you've not spoken to each other. You've held off talking about how much your life means to you, how much those people have meant to your life, how, you know, you can exchange feelings that, I don't know about other Lutherans, but boy, they were sure hard to cough up in my family. Just, you know, good German Lutheran stock, and we don't talk about these things, but maybe we should. It was wonderful. Well, it's 11:30. Anybody of you need any more of these? Okay, there's a stack right here. Please help yourself.
Thank you.
I have the living will, so.
Oh!
I'm going to be here.
Yeah. Do you have a durable power of attorney? That's not a bad idea. That'll give you a little. Yeah. Name someone, because if you get sick and you can't speak, then you have that person who will speak for you. Yeah. I don't think so. Anyone that can dress up with different earrings every time I see you.
Uh-huh.
It's just drenching.
And then they look at him, look at the rest away.
It sounds like family.
And then this Friday train family.
So you had that too, huh?
Not my family, but family's in the church.
It's just terrible. You say things that you'll never forget. Yeah.
And you regret.
Yes. Yes, and that you regret deeply.
Thank you for helping me. You know, just to be reassured. We don't eat yet, do we?
Oh, there's one at 11:45 and then at 1. And I'm on dish duty, so I'm already late.